With less than 5% of the planet's population, the United States has nearly one quarter of the world's prison population. Today's guest traces the politics and policy decisions since President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty that created the nation's reliance on mass incarceration. She's Elizabeth Hinton this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, scholars, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Elizabeth Hinton, a professor at Harvard University who's the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's a huge sweep of issues that we want to talk about with you, from poverty to criminal justice, to mass incarceration, and what happens after people get out. But let's start first with you and how you came to be interested in these issues.
So I am a child of the 80s and kind of came of age in the 90s. And so I witnessed firsthand, you know, the ramping up of the war on drugs, the crack epidemic, and the impact of the rise of mass incarceration on my own family. So I had family members just like many other black people in this country who were going in and out of prison and who abused crack. And I knew that there was kind of a larger story there because I knew firsthand the forces that led my own family members to drug abuse and incarceration that wasn't being talked about. So this was something that was kind of very animated throughout my childhood. At the same time, though, you know, we weren't really having public conversations about incarceration and the impact of mass incarceration on families in the 90s. And there was a lot of shame that I had, that family members had, about what was going on. And so it wasn't until I started graduate school in the early 2000s that I actually started visiting family of mine who were incarcerated. And the first time that I went to a prison, I could not believe what I was seeing, because this was 2005. This was before mass incarceration was the buzzword that it is today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a visitor visiting loved ones in prison, you go through, you're with other mostly, I was visiting a male relative, mostly women and children. You kind of go through a process of criminalization with the guards yourself, and you're being surveilled, and you have to abide by a very strict dress code and all of these things. You get into the visiting room, and, you know, I witnessed all of these young black and brown men interacting with their children, playing games, and I was just like, oh my gosh, how did we get here? How is it that generations of men of color are behind bars in a faraway place, far, far away from the community that they're from, and the impact, you know, you see it firsthand in the visiting room what this has on family members. And I said, you know, I was starting a PhD program in history, and I said, all right, you know, I really, really want to get to the bottom of this. How did we get here? You know, and this was something at the time, again, that was so invisible. It's not, we weren't talking about it, and prison seemed very, very, very far away now, 15 years ago.
Is there a moment in, so we want to talk more about sort of the what you have done in your scholarship, mm-hmm. but is there a moment in the American consciousness where what triggered the new conversation about mass incarceration?
I think, you know, one of the big moments that helped to push the conversation forward was the release of Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which was like synthesized all of this research coming out of the 90s and the 2000s. The New Jim Crow was released in 2010, which of course was the beginnings of the kind of criminal justice reform that we begin to see in the Obama administration. But I think that Michelle Alexander captured and through the concept of the new Jim Crow made really, really clear the ways in which racism is entrenched in the criminal justice system and brought a lot of attention to the problem of mass incarceration. And I think galvanized and mobilized many people to become aware of the issue in ways that they hadn't before. I think also the unrest in Ferguson and Baltimore in 2014 and 15 really, in the age of social media, really opened up new conversations about policing and police brutality, which of course is deeply related to incarceration mm-hmm. itself. So I think Michelle Alexander's book gave, I think, a generation of activists new tools to understand and put in kind of a fuller context what was happening in Ferguson and Baltimore.
So the World Prison Brief, which is based mm-hmm. at the University of London, counts prisoners in countries around the world. Mm-hmm. And by their estimation, by their count, there are 2.1, 2.2 million Americans incarcerated, by far more than any other country yeah. in the world. You've talked about who some of these people are. Mm-hmm. Just give us sort of the global view. Who are these 2.2 million people? But racially, in terms mm-hmm. of economic background, just give us a snapshot mm-hmm. here.
Well, historically, kind of the rise of prisons coincides with the rise of the modern age and global capitalism. And historically, prisons have been used to confine the most marginalized and poor populations globally. So what we're seeing in the U.S., most of the people incarcerated here lack the kind of educational opportunities that those on the outside have. Most come from low-income backgrounds, and of course, disparate numbers of the U.S. prison population are people of color. Similarly, globally, prison populations tend to be people who are poor, people who are oppressed, disenfranchised, marginalized. In one way or another.
So a lot of these people in the United States who are incarcerated are not there for what you would call a serious crime, meaning murder or something of that sort. There are a lot of people there for relatively minor drug offenses. There are relatively minor petty theft related to their own economic survival, perhaps. Talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that, because I think some people have an image of everyone behind bars is just irredeemable, did something really horrible, needs to stay there, needs to be punished, mm-hmm. never to get free again.
So there was a question through the 1970s about how our law enforcement policies should treat drug abuse. And in the 1980s, those questions really became resolved, and there was a move on the part of federal policymakers, also at the state level, to criminalize drug users and drug abuse and to enact really, really harsh penalties for nonviolent drug crimes. And this is something that is quite unique to the United States, and it's also related, of course, to the ways in which certain communities are policed. So this, the metaphor of the war on drugs in many communities really, really did take the form of a war on those communities, a war on not necessarily drug dealers, but also drug users. And, for example, the targeting of crack cocaine offenses and those in possession of crack cocaine really, really ramped up the U.S. prison population. So these, the decision to target certain offenses has real consequences in terms of who's incarcerated, who's not. And of course, policymakers at all levels of government could have decided to respond, as we're beginning to talk about today with the opioid crisis, to drug abuse in an entirely different way. Instead of saying, okay, if you're using drugs, we're going to lock you up for a really, really long time, and especially if it's your third time caught in some kind of drug transaction, you're in for life. Say, okay, it's really clear that, and this really would have benefited many members of my family. It's clear that you need help. Let's think about how to get you treatment. This really is the mark of a transition from a kind of what might have been a public health approach to an issue to a crime control, law enforcement, punitive approach.
So what is it? I mean, so. Well, why in the 1980s did I remember sort of the much heralded war on crime and the war on drugs? Mm-hmm. What why that approach as opposed to public health approach?
So there's a number of ways to approach that question. I mean, I think part of it is, and what my book argues is that actually, you know, the war on drugs did begin in the 80s, but the kind of beginnings of the modern system of criminal justice and the origins of mass incarceration begin in an unlikely place, which is in the mid-60s, so at the height of the civil rights movement and progressive social change. And one of the things that I found in my book is that, you know, that policymakers, a bipartisan coalition of policymakers led by the great Lyndon Johnson, decided to fight a war on poverty and a war on crime side by side. And in part, the war on crime was an attempt to prevent urban unrest, because as you know, in the 1960s, this was a period of widespread urban disorder or rioting during every summer of Johnson's presidency. And the response was, okay, again, instead of thinking, well, how can we kind of make a more comprehensive intervention to, you know, by empowering people with better employment opportunities and jobs and improving our public schools and improving housing in low-income communities. That effort never really got off the ground. Instead, there's a massive investment on the part of federal policymakers beginning in the 1960s into a major war on crime. And so much of that has to do with American racism. I think, you know, in some ways, the decision to expand and invest in local law enforcement for the first time in U.S. history in the 1960s follows this historical pattern. So after emancipation in 1865, after the Civil War, there is a mini mass incarceration, and all these new laws are put on the books in the southern states as an attempt to kind of force newly freed people back into punitive labor regimes known as the convict lease system. And you begin to see disparate rates of incarceration for black people in the late 19th century. Then 100 years later, you know, in the direct context of the Civil Rights Act and the dismantling of Jim Crow, you get kind of a new policing program, and you get a new investment in police forces, and you get federal policymakers making a conscious decision to target young black men between the ages of 15 and 24 who they believe to be particularly susceptible to crime and violence and responsible for the unrest in nearly every major American city during Johnson's presidency.
Do you think Johnson knew this would be the effect, the impact that this would happen, or do you think he was well-intentioned?
So that's something that I really struggled with in writing the book, and I struggled with this for years. I really believe that Johnson launched the Great Society in an attempt to improve American society. He, you know, he was very deeply committed to making a lasting change and making America a more equitable place as much as he saw fit. His administration, building from some of the work of the Kennedy administration, really wanted to address racial discrimination. But the thing is, you know, his urban policy ended up being this kind of carrot and stick approach, which is, you know, social welfare programs via the war on poverty and crime control programs and new power for police departments via the war on crime. And unfortunately, and I don't think he necessarily foresaw this, but the war on poverty programs ended up waning out, and we got a kind of lasting crime control law enforcement infrastructure. So one thing that really illustrates this well is the Office of Economic Opportunity, which was formed in 1964 and was the kind of major office within the executive branch that that fought the war on poverty. The following year, the Office of Law Enforcement Assistance was formed, and that was the executive branch level DOJ entity that would fight the war on crime. And by 1968, even, so that early, at the very end of Johnson's presidency, a more permanent office is established in the Department of Justice. That's kind of the grown-up entity of the Office of Law Enforcement Assistance called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And the Office of Economic Opportunity never got that kind of permanent body and investment on the part of federal policymakers.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books, including the recently published Kid Number One. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Elizabeth Hinton, a member of the faculty at Harvard University. Her book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, traces the evolution of mass incarceration in the United States. She's on Twitter at Eliza B. Hinton, ElizaBHinton.
Did legislators, policymakers, the country see then, and this is a question very pertinent for today too, the impact not only on the inmate, but on the people left behind by that inmate, in many cases children, in many cases, a spouse, people who have somebody suddenly gone and like really gone?
Well, I think that, you know, there is an awareness of some of the socioeconomic issues facing low-income urban communities where they are experiencing a lot of people see as over-policing and under-protection. And despite this, and despite even, you know, as early as 1968, recommendations from the Kerner Commission, which was the task force that Johnson called to address the problems of violence in the U.S., he called it in the middle of the Detroit riot in 1967, the Kerner Commission said we need a Marshall Plan for American cities, and we need a major investment in, you know, jobs, employment, schools. These are the kind of programs that might have addressed the widening inequality that emerged during the 1970s and would have addressed, I think, the kind of impact on policing and incarceration as it's rising in the 1970s on low-income families. But again, instead of really kind of committing that kind of investment and policies to really move people out of poverty in a meaningful way. As I write, you know, federal policymakers decided to kind of manage inequality through policing programs and eventually incarceration and a kind of law enforcement program that gets more and more punitive, taking the form of the even more draconian war on drugs that we see emerging in the 1980s.
I'm sort of curious, as a historian, how sort of like the body of documentation that you had to work from over 2.5 decades of content, that's an enormous undertaking.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about just sort of the research that went into this book.
Yeah, so I consulted the White House Central Files of every presidential administration from Kennedy to Reagan, and literally requested, did Freedom of Information Act requests and viewed every single document that I could get my hands on related to crime, drugs, poverty, social welfare programs. And, you know, I'm a historian, I'm a nerd, I love archives. I love doing archival work, and I started with the Nixon archives, and when I got into the federal sources for the first time, I had done in undergrad and graduate school organizational histories up until this, and I realized this is really my calling. So in addition to that, going through, I also love reading congressional hearings. I just live for this stuff. And it was really exciting to me and also surprising, some of what I found, and I was surprised also by some of the things I didn't find. But
What's something that did surprise you?
So one of the documents that was kind of gave me chills when I saw this was the Long Range Master Plan, this planning document that was in the Nixon archives that basically Nixon and his John Mitchell, his attorney general, got together and decided that they were going to revolutionize, that the prison system needed to be revolutionized, and that his administration was going to be the one to lead it, and basically started or conceived of this 10-year plan for the Bureau of Prisons that would expand the U.S. prison system. And they based this plan on prison population projections. So I'm in the archive, and this is written in 1970, and I'm looking at prison population projections that are showing how much the federal prison system is expected to grow by the 1980s. And these projections were based on population projections that Johnson's Crime Commission and the Kerner Commission that I mentioned did about the about black youth populations. Again, this population of black youth between the ages of 15 and 24. And when I saw this in the archive, that really, really surprised me. But another thing, let me say quickly about Nixon. I started going to the papers when they were undergoing a transition, and so they were moved from the National Archives in College Park to his presidential library in Yorba Linda, California, and a lot of the presidential stuff wasn't hadn't been sorted yet, so I got to just kind of go through boxes, and you know, I saw personal letters between Nixon and his daughter, Julie, and I got it kind of a more of a layered sense of him as a person. So as much as some of the policies that he this kind of planning for mass incarceration essentially was shocking to me, I also got to see a personal side.
I just want to make sure that I understood what you said there, though, that the Nixon administration's plans for building more prisons, were the numbers that they were using were driven by the age of the African-American male population.
Youth population, yes.
Wow.
Yep, this is all, it's all in the book, and some of the charts are too.
Were there any voices at the time saying this is so wrong?
Of course, and even, you know, as the Nixon administration is setting out to expand the prison system, there's a huge prisoners' rights movement going on, and even federal officials are calling for an end to prison construction, saying, okay, we've got to rethink this approach in terms of dealing with crime. There might be, we should think about prevention, or we should think about halfway houses or community-based corrections. And so, you know, what was even more kind of shocking about these plans is that this is in the face of so much of what's going on. I know that you had Heather Ann Thompson here with you before, and, you know, her book is just a magisterial account of the most kind of important prisoners' rights moment during this time, which is, of course, the Attica prison uprising. And so this is, you know, this planning document comes a year before Attica, but the, you know, my research shows that a lot of what Nixon, Mitchell, and the Bureau of Prisons conceived of ended up coming to fruition.
So it wasn't simply federal policy. State by state, many states were doing exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you take a look at that and see what the factors were comparing one state to another?
Yeah. So what's really interesting, too, I mean, of course, you know, states vary in terms of how much money they're allocating to prisons. But in this moment, and so there's, I get into a lot of debate on, well, you know, prisons and law enforcement is really a state and local issue, so the federal government doesn't have that much to do with it. But it does, because at this time that Nixon is, you know, imagining a kind of a new threshold of incarceration in the U.S., there's also changes to the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act that was enacted under Lyndon Johnson to incentivize prison construction for the states. So once the federal policymakers call the war on crime, begin to say this is a new priority, state and local governments then follow, because that's where the available grants are. So, you know, we were talking about kind of this question about why did the war on poverty wane out? And part of it, too, is that so many of the what were once social welfare programs available through the Office of Economic Opportunity end up becoming crime prevention programs awarded through the Permanent Law Enforcement Assistance Administration.
You know, there's been a lot of churn, I'd say, in the last half dozen years about reform, particularly around nonviolent drug offenses.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
President Trump has actually taken some swings at this, working with Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you can put that most recent set of reforms into the context of your book, but also what additional work still remains to be done.
So, you know, this was when the First Step Act of 2018 passed. You know, a lot of people said, oh, this is a great moment of bipartisan reform. And one of the things, you know, I think initially people saw the rise of mass incarceration as being kind of this thing that happened in the 80s as this kind of evil program that Reagan planned. And no, I mean, Johnson was the architect, I show of modern American law enforcement. And of course, you know, Bill Clinton with the 1994 crime bill really, I mean, that legislation is like the single most important catalyst for mass incarceration and the explosion of prison populations as we see it today. So it's not surprising that, you know, I think the First Step Act passed in December 2018, and it was kind of sold as this Christmas story. Like, despite all the discord in Washington, you know, Democrats and Republicans are coming together. again, I think some of that momentum can be attributed to Michelle Alexander's book and kind of the growing awareness about mass incarceration, but it is really a baby step forward. It's like an infant step forward. There's still so much work that needs to be done. And one of the things that the legislation is doing or does is address this very issue, this kind of move to decarcerate nonviolent drug offenders. And I think that that is where the kind of thrust of reform is happening today. So there's that. You know, we talked earlier about the crack cocaine sentencing disparity, which was lessened by Obama Sentencing Act in 2010. So that makes it retroactive. There are a couple of forward-looking elements of the legislation, but we really have a long way to go.
So another way to address this problem is through diversion programs. Mm-hmm. Have you taken a look at diversion programs? Are they effective? Where are they being used effectively? Where could they be used today?
Right. So part of it is, you know, really rethinking what is the most effective way to prevent crime? And I think that this is, you know, the First Step Act is this attempt to decarcerate, but also to provide more comprehensive reentry programs. And the thing is, we've really got, you know, talk about, again, investment. If we really want to give people a second chance, then we really have to invest in not just job training, but jobs for formerly incarcerated people and ensuring that they're in a safe environment where they're living and educational opportunities. We've got to, like, think about, you know, The approach to preventing crime by policing people and incarcerating them for the past 50-some years has not worked. So we need a different kind of approach, which is investing in public schools, creating jobs for people, giving people a path away from prison or, in many communities, gun violence.
We got about a minute left here. What about what happens when you're in prison or when you come out? I mean, the sort of, we've had guests on talking about sort of the lack of rehabilitation in America's
right.
prison systems,
Most prisoners get out,
right.
Eventually.
Mm-hmm. And so, where does your research lead you on that issue in particular?
Well, again,
we got about 30 seconds.
Yeah,
left.
I mean, we've really got to rethink in this country, and it's not just about nonviolent drug offenses. You know, why we punish, how we do, and think about ways that we can empower people to become productive and meaningful members of society when they get out of prison. And right now, our prison system does not do that. It's as the, you know, the unrest in Mississippi prisons and the deaths are going on there. Prisons, in too many cases, are just dens of brutality, abuse, and neglect that aren't changing lives. So we've got a long, long way to go.
Elizabeth, that's an important place to leave the conversation. Thank you so much. She's Elizabeth Hinton. The book is From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.